wherever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS radio network.
Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone.
Whether it's discussing American Christian heritage, current events, law and government, Islam and the Quran, or more, William Federer's vast knowledge of such issues combined with his bold, informative answers and dynamic speaking abilities make him an excellent, excellent interview guest no matter where he is. He's America's God. He's for America's God and Country, the Encyclopedia of Quotation. That's one of the books he wrote, sold over 500,000 copies. And he's been featured on TV, radio, and in print, C-SPAN, Fox News, Hannity and Combs, O'Reilly Factor, the 700 Club, and it goes on and on. And he is no stranger to this microphone. Bill Hay, welcome back.
Michael, great to be with you.
Boy, it's been a while since we've talked.
Well, I've just been beating my drum, trying to make a difference, but I sure appreciate you.
Oh, by the way, thank you so much. By the way, speaking about making a difference, the world in and of itself, Bill, you keep your fingers basically on the pulse of what's happening. What is it that the average person isn't seeing in the world today? There's an underlying something that's going on, and it's changing, but it hasn't quite surfaced yet. What are we looking at?
Well, that's the more or less the premise of my new book. It's Change to Chains. It's a 6,000-year quest for control. And when we look at the day-to-day newspaper, should we raise the debt limit, should we not, you sort of get lost in the muddle. But if you stand back from the tree and look at the forest, in other words, zoom out from us and look at all of world history, we get a fascinating perspective. And that's one of the things I've done is researched every single civilization and empire in world history. Now, it sounds daunting, but it is finite. In other words, the first human records appear about 3 or 4,000 B.C., Egyptian hieroglyphics, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets, and 4,000 B.C., 2080, that's 6,000 years. And 6,000 years is really not that long. It's just 60 people living 100 years each back-to-back. And you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. 60
Bill, let me
people,
ask you this.
You know, we've all met somebody that, or know somebody that's lived 100 years. Just 60 of those, all the way, you know, one dies, the other's born. And you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. And one of the things I've found fascinating, and I document all these empires in my book, is that the default setting for human government is what? Monarchy. Power gravitates into the hands of one person. And whether we call that one person a pharaoh, a Caesar, a sultan, a kaiser, a czar, an Aztec Montezuma, a Chinese emperor, an Indian maharaja, that this is the default setting. In other words, you drop a bunch of people in the woods, you'll wind up with an Indian chief. You drop a bunch of people in an inner city, you wind up with a gang leader. And so power naturally, like magnets, like the Lord of the Rings, everybody wants that ring of power, wants to concentrate. And so in the book, I give a overview of these, and then I highlight the dozen or so major alternatives to monarchy in world history. The Book of Judges, one of the first instances of people, a nation, not having a king. And that's also the first instance of private ownership of agricultural land. And then also Athens, they had a democracy where everybody voted in on everything. And then there was a Roman Republic. For about 500 years, Rome did not have a king. The story is that Publius was one of the Roman leaders, and there was a guy whose daughter Lucretia had been raped by the king. And they decided to kill the king, and then they passed a law in Rome that if anybody would declare himself king, anybody could kill that person without repercussions. So nobody wanted to be a king. So Rome was ruled by senators, about 600 of them, and they were hereditary. They were not elected. And over the centuries, they became the aristocracy, and the people got into debt. And so one of the bankrupt families of this aristocracy had a guy named Julius Caesar. Was a good general, but he was ambitious politically, and he raided the treasury in Rome at the Temple of Saturn, took the money to buy supporters, ended up making himself dictator for life. And so it was Caesar that transitioned the Roman Republic into the Roman Empire. But what I do in this book is I go through these, the Italian city-states, which were sort of a nobleman's republic, the Icelandic Commonwealth about 800 AD, where they had different tribes and they'd sort of have a judgeship of ruling between them all until finally the King of Denmark conquered them. And there was the Seven United Netherlands, where they had settlements from Japan to India to South Africa to South America to New York. And the Dutch had a unique way of raising money without a king. It was called the stock market, the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. And, of course, their New Amsterdam one, when the British took over, turned into the New York Stock Exchange. So that's still a remnant of the Dutch Republic. But then England, during its Puritan Revolution for about 15 years, was a commonwealth. It did not have a king. They had chopped off Charles I's head. And then comes along America. And America, because of our 3,000-mile ocean between us and our monarch, the King of England, we had one of these unique opportunities to experiment with a government without a king. And it worked. We took the power of a king, separated it into three branches, then separated it federal to state level. Then we tied up this new federal Frankenstein with 10 handcuffs we call the First 10 Amendments. I mean, the founders were preoccupied with one thing, preventing the reaccumulation of power into the hands of one person. Well, time has gone by, and after every crisis, we've seen this gravitational pull resurrect. We've seen this pull of the rubber band. In other words, it was great that Lincoln ended slavery, but in the process, a lot of powers went from the states back to the hands of the federal government. And it was great that Woodrow Wilson got us through World War I, but in the process, he concentrated power with the Federal Reserve and the federal income tax. And it was great that Franklin Roosevelt got us through the Depression, but in the process, he concentrated power with his New Deal programs. And then Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, his Great Society socialist programs, concentrated power in the federal government. And even President Bush with the War on Terror, so the government can read your emails and track every credit card purchase and strip search at the airport. Now, it's usually for a short-term good, like ending slavery and preventing terrorist attacks, but you can't help but see the trend of going from separated power to concentrated power. And now that new administration that's in office is putting it on an exponential curve on steroids, taking over banks, car companies, and life and death health care decisions of every single citizen. So he who dictates is effectively a dictator. And so we're transitioning away from government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and back to the enlightened few, the philosopher king that considers himself wiser than the rest, and power it reconcentrates back. And Woodrow Wilson said it, the history of liberty is the history of limitation on government power, not the increase of it. He said, when we resist the concentration of power, we are resisting the powers of death, because concentration of power always precedes the destruction of human liberties. Reagan put it this way, a government that's big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you have. But that's it. That's the premise of the book, Change to Chains, and I document it all the way through there. It took a couple years to put it together. But it's fascinating to see where we fit in this picture. So, again, if you say, well, are we just raising the debt limit? You know, this is nothing, no big deal. But when you stand back and you see this 6,000-year quest, and each time these empires, with the stakes would get higher. You know, you had the Genghis Khan and the Mongolian Empire, you know, and then you had the King of Spain. I mean, the sun never set on the Spanish Empire. And then England upped him one, and was the sun never set on the English Empire. I mean, the King of England had the largest empire in the world, 13 million square miles and a half a billion people, all basically ruled by one guy. And so we see that, when we see this world history and where we fit into it, it helps us to understand what's going on today.
No, I think the real big question here is obviously it's cyclical, and you would think, I'm going to say you would think, that we would see this coming. If you go back to Hitler during the Second World War, before the Second World War, what he was doing with Germany, nationalized the banking industry, nationalized education, and the list goes on, which we see the exact same thing going on here. If we see it and we know it, why don't we stop it? What is it that causes us to stay in apathy until it's too late? We turn around and we realize that we are now in a concentrated power and we're stuck and the individual has no rights at all.
Well, you touch upon a whole nother set of philosophers. Now, America's founders were really into Montesquieu and John Locke and these guys that would take this concentrated power of a king and separate it. But there's a whole other set of philosophers that wanted to do the opposite, take separated power and concentrate it. One of them was Machiavelli. He lived 500 years ago in Italy. Now, Italy was not Italy 500 years ago. It was a bunch of city-states, Venice, Genoa, Siena, Naples, and they all had armies and navies, and they always fought. So Machiavelli had an idea. He thought if the prince wanted to concentrate all the power and took control of all these Italian-speaking city-states, there would be peace. And so he wrote a book called The Prince, and in there he advocated that the ends justifies the means. So the end of one prince controlling all of Italy is so good because there would be peace that any means necessary to get there is justified. Lie, cheat, steal, and so forth. So here's the scenario. If the prince wants to conquer a city and they don't want to be conquered, they'd hate him. But if he pays criminals to kill cows, burn barns, create crisis and terror, the people would cry out for help. The prince would come in and kill the very guy that he bribed. Nobody would know the better for it, and they'd praise the prince as a hero. So either way he conquers the city, one way he's hated, the other way he's loved. And it's really good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go on the back of the house, set it on fire, then you go on the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher, and they'll pay anything and thank you for being there. And so this Machiavellianism is you create or capitalize on a crisis to consolidate control. That was 500 years ago he said this. And now we see statements like the president's former chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, saying never let a good crisis go to waste. That's Machiavellianism. And then there was another philosopher named Hegel, H-E-G-E-L. Hegel lived in Germany in the early 1800s, and he had a theory called dialectics. Now, it's not a diet method. It's a triangle. One corner is a thesis. The opposite corner is an antithesis or antithesis. And the top corner is a synthesis. And so the idea is you create an antithesis. You create a problem that's real bad, and then everybody's happy to settle for the synthesis, the answer that's half as bad. And then that becomes the new starting point, the new thesis. Then you create another problem that's real bad, and everybody settles for your answer that's half as bad. And you keep doing this over and over again, and you gradually move across the page from separated power to concentrated power. Now, Hegel inspired Karl Marx, who started communism. And his idea was to create the antithesis, you would find the fault lines in a community, whether it was the rich against the poor, the blacks against the whites, the Catholics against the Protestants, the Christians against the Muslims, or the Hutus against the Tutsis in the Congo. Really don't care who the two sides are. What you do is you send your labor organizers and community organizers into the countries to find that group of people that feel slighted, that feel like they're on the bottom of the totem pole. And you play upon their lust. You say, hey, you want what the other ones have, right? And they say, yeah. And they say, well, follow me. And so this is the creating of the antithesis. You create a crisis. And when there's finally bloodshed and riots and violence, then everybody is willing to give up their freedoms to have order restored. And that's when you usurp control and you set up a communist dictatorship. And Stalin, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Castro, Mao Tse-Tung. And in a sense, communism is nothing more than monarchy. Every communist country is ruled by a dictator. He's like the king. And the Communist Party members are the new royalty. They get to decide who lives in the nice houses and so forth. And then the people are the peasants, the subjects. But this idea of creating an antithesis, you go into the countries and you organize the have-nots against the haves. This inspired, by the way, 45 countries felt the communism this way. This inspired a Chicago community organizer named Saul Alinsky. Now, Hillary Clinton wrote her master's thesis on Saul Alinsky, and the current president was a community organizer using Saul Alinsky's methods. And so Saul Alinsky says the community organizer's job is to rub raw the resentments of a community, fan the latent flames of hostility to the point of overt expression. Because unless the people are motivated to act, there will not be change. He says that you, the community organizer, seeks out crisis and problems, stirs up racism and hatred. And so this is the idea, is that you see every crisis, whether it's a debt crisis, a swine flu crisis, an avian flu, a Gulf oil spill, an immigration crisis, the answer is always the same. Give the government more control of your life, and they'll take care of everything. And so, again, we're seeing this thesis, antithesis, synthesis. We're seeing this, you create or capitalize on a crisis to consolidate control. And this inspired two Columbia University professors, Cloward and Piven, and they said the best crisis is a debt crisis. And so they, in New York, had everybody sign up for welfare, created their welfare system, and they had to appeal to the state for help. Giuliani mentioned these professors by name for helping to do this. But it's this idea that, let's go back and look at Egypt. The 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine story that most people are familiar with in the book of Genesis with Joseph. At the first year of famine, what happened in Egypt? Well, people said, bad economy, high unemployment, we don't have money for food. Government, take our cattle, give us food. Second year, still hasn't turned around. Government, take our land, give us food. Finally, take us, take our kids, our posterity, just give us some crumbs. And all the power in the country was concentrated into the hands of one person, the Pharaoh. Now, if your agenda is to concentrate power, and you could intentionally create the crisis, people would sell their souls and their posterity just to get a welfare check. And this is where Stalin said, crises are necessary to demand and obtain total submission of all citizens. And anyway, it's a fascinating study, and it helps us to understand what's going on right now.
Hey, Bill Fetter, we're starting to run out of time. I want to get you back on, and I want to talk about the Quran.
Oh, right. So, I'd love to. I wrote a book and a DVD on that that's becoming a bestseller as well.
I got it. I hear you loud and clear. By the way, I know what you're doing, believe it or not. I watch. Anyway, we're website we can find you in the books at.
AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. And the main book I talked about today was Change to Chains, a little play on word, Change to Chains, The 6,000-Year Quest for Control.
Hey, loud and clear. Hey, Bill, thank you, and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Victoria Christopher Murray, coming up next.
There are so many simply incredible places to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Dresser After Dark. Victoria Christopher Murray with us, the author of The Deal, The Dance, and The Devil. She's the author of 10 best-selling novels, including The X-Files, Too Little, Too Late, The Lady Jasmine, and she's also the author of about 10 inspirational series, The Divine Divas. She lives with a family in Los Angeles, California, and let us say, Victoria, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Los Angeles, I remember Los Angeles when you could drive from L.A. to San Diego, and San Diego was a little sleepy town of 50,000 people, and there was nothing but little tiny beach towns between L.A. and San Diego. And I think that must have been about 200 years ago.
Yeah, well, it's grown a little bit, but it's still small compared. San Diego's still very small compared to Los Angeles.
Oh, sure, no question about it. Okay, let's talk the deal, the dance, and the devil. What is it when you decided to put it to pen? Did the title come first, or did the title fall into play as the idea was created?
Well, the title actually fell into play. I always say this. I've written all these books, and I can write a 400-page novel, but it takes me 400 years to come up with a title. And I usually just let the characters tell me what the title's going to be. And that's what happened. I had a bunch of titles before I settled on The Deal, The Dance, and The Devil. And as soon as I was probably about 3/4 of the way through with the book. But as soon as I got that title, I knew that was it.
Yeah, sometimes it just hits. There's a little millisecond of something when you know it's exactly right. Now,
yes.
the book in and itself, the takeaway, what's the core message? What do I get as the reader?
As the reader, you get that many people want to believe in God, and many people do believe in God, but we don't believe that there's the opposite side. We don't really believe in the devil, and that we better believe in the devil as well. We better not believe in it, but know that a devil exists.
Okay, but is the devil I don't mean a physical thing, but is the devil the absolute God reality, but the opposite side of the spectrum?
Well, you know what? I don't know. Because one of the things that I do, I write novels, I write fiction. And so I'm not a pastor, and
yeah,
I'm not trying to be anyone's pastor, but I just let the messages come as I'm writing. I don't sit down before the book and say, what's my message going to be? I approach all of my books as a creative, as a creative person, as an artist. And I just tell the story. And because of my face shows up in my stories.
Sure.
And then the message starts unfolding. So it's not that I start with such a deep message or something that I want to convey. It wasn't until the very last page of this book that I said, wow, look at this message. I think really what this book shows more than anything else is that there is good in this world and there is evil. And we better recognize, because we so often focus on the good, and that's what we should be doing, but we better recognize that there's evil there as well.
And if you get offered something, and if the deal is too good, you might want to look underneath it to make sure that you're not ripped.
Yeah, because this deal looks very good.
Very good, yes. And as a matter of fact, I remember years ago, William Shatner was in one of those series, and it was just a half-hour series, and he was on a plane. And he got to a point where he was a defrocked preacher and did not believe in God anymore and was drinking and whatever. And in the luggage compartment of the plane, there was an evil force back there. And to make the long story short, at the very end of the movie, he was going to die, but he figured if he walked back there and if he faced it, if there's bad, there's got to be good.
Yes.
And I think that's the reverse. No matter what, yeah. And the idea.
Yeah, and I think that's the message.
Okay, now absolutely. So when we talk about good and evil, we can take it in such a way that realize that if you're not dwelling in the world of good, watch out for what you get presented with and what will make you follow something. Because again, the end of the rainbow, you don't know what that pot of gold really has for you. It could be 15 or 20 years of the greatest life in the world and an eternity of hell.
Exactly. And that's what I was trying to show in this novel, because the couple in the book, they're living in their own little Garden of Eden. I wanted this book to almost be a modern-day Garden of Eden story. And this couple's living so well, and so you would never expect evil to come into their lives. But they've let just a little piece in. And once a little piece of evil steps into their life, their entire world explodes. And so you really do have to be careful, because there's a reason why we have all of those cliches, all that glitters ain't gold, and things like that, because it's true.
Now, by the way, when you really come down to it, the when we get offered something, it has to do with perceived value. If I could offer you a check for $150 million today, no strings attached, I mean, and there was nothing behind it, it would probably give you some sense of satisfaction. But what if you knew that if you accepted the check next Friday, you would have to die? All of a sudden, the value of that money is not what you thought it was. And I think that's what happens with most people. We don't get into what the real value is. What does it mean? What's the consequence of accepting something? Is it a good thing? And then on top of that, even if there's no evil behind it, do you have the ability to deal with it and go through life and not turn yourself?
Well, you know, that's what I wanted to show also, was that you really have to count the cost. You have to count the cost of everything good and count the cost of everything bad. And or because it's not until you count the cost that you're going to be able to discern whether something is all good for you or something's all bad for you. And in this novel, this couple is living this great life, but now because of the recession, they're on the brink of financial disaster. And so the wife is offered $5 million. If she gives up her husband for a weekend with this woman. And, you know, it looks like a deal at first that they just definitely don't want to take. And then they look at it and they're responsible for so many people in their lives. So now they're saying, well, it's just a weekend and we'll have the rest of our lives. And they never counted the consequences. They never really took a look at what it was going to cost.
And I wonder how many times in our lives that it's not $5 million and it's not a weekend with somebody else, but there's those choices that we're put in front of us to make. And it may not be to the degree that you're talking about, but when you exemplify something, it's got to be an extreme. But how many times in our lives, it's just that little bit of something that we take because at the time we want it and we don't look at what's beyond it. And I think the message is in there for everybody. It does not have to be as exaggerated as somebody walks in and say, here's $5 million and your significant other is going to go spend a weekend with somebody. That's an extreme. But look at all the small things that happen in life with the same consequence.
Well, that's what I really like about the book and the way people are reacting to it. The emails that I'm getting and messages on my website from people saying, you know what, I'm not going through this exactly, obviously, but I was just about to do something that I wasn't sure about, and this book has brought the reality of evil straight into my face. And so most people get it. Most people get that it's an allegory. It's almost a fable that I'm writing with a lesson in the middle of it, because people get it. Everything that glitters ain't gold.
Yeah, absolutely, and there's no question about that. Did the idea come up in the beginning, or did you just sit down and as it began to flow, you started to get it?
The idea came up in the beginning. I was actually thinking about that movie, Indecent Proposal, and what I was thinking about was that if you, and I wasn't thinking about a book, I watched it on television, and I said, you know what, if you flip this around where a person came to the woman with the deal, and then it was for her husband, and if you expanded it just a little, it's a totally different story. And I said, wow, that sure becomes more almost like the Garden of Eden. And I was just thinking about it, watching that movie, and I didn't even think about it in terms of it being a book. But when it came time for me to do my new contract and was thinking of a book idea, that came right back to my mind. But that's usually how it is for me. The stories, the plot comes first, the what-if question, and then I develop characters to tell the story. I don't have the whole thing mapped out in my head, but I know the gist of the story. I know the people who are living in my head for that story, and then I just sit down and I write.
And then what we have to do after the show's over, we'll send Robert Redford some flowers and say thank you.
Yes, and then Moses for writing Genesis.
Absolutely. Victoria, we're just about out of time. A website we can find you at and where we can buy the books and find out more.
Well, the good thing is that you can buy the books anywhere in any store in the country or online at any of the online retailers. And if anyone wants to read the first chapter of my this book, The Deal, The Dance, and the Devil, or any of my other novels, they can go to my website, which is my name, and that's www.victoriachristophermurray.com. And they can read the first chapter of this novel and any of the other ones.
Wonderful. Hey, Victoria, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
We're warm over the night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toast. There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see.
Welcome back, I'm Michael Ray, you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Just be only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me.
J.J. Virgin with us. Dr. J.J. Virgin with us. She's the author of 6 Weeks to Sleeveless and Sexy, the 5-Step Plan to Sleek, Strong, and Very Sculptured Arms. And let us say, J.J., hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Oh, by the way, thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about it, I know you've dealt a lot with a lot of high-ranking professionals and experts and so on and so forth. But when you really come down to it, when the average person, I've watched people lose weight for years, and the big problem they have, JJ, is too much skin in the arms, underneath the chin, and so on and so forth. And I've actually seen people frightened to death to lose weight because they're afraid of what their arms are going to look like. Where was it that you saw that this was a major problem?
You know, it's one of those light bulb moments. Maybe it's more like a duh moment. And actually it happened, I was at a business event, and someone came up and asked me how I got my arms. I always go sleeveless. I'm one of those people that runs hot, so I don't like to wear sleeves. And for literally years, women have been asking me about my arms. What I didn't do, I didn't connect the dots to discover that there's a lot of what I call arm angst out there, that women are very self-conscious about their arms, and which seems to be such a shame because, honestly, it's one of the easier body parts to fix. Now, I'll give it to you. When you lose a lot of weight and you have a lot of hanging skin, that's a whole different ballgame. But,
no question.
You know, but if someone just wants to tone up and tighten up their arms, it's literally 6 weeks can make a massive difference.
Now, by the way, in the 6 weeks, is there a combination of things to do? Is it, you know, obviously there's got to be some form of exercise, some form of a nutritional program. What is it that they do this?
Well, I think that's where this really differs, and I sort of, you know, I think someone picking up the book might think, oh, okay, it's a diet and exercise plan, but it actually is much more of an integrated health program disguised, right? I use the hook of getting great arms, but when you really look at getting great arms, it's really about being much healthier, and some of the most important things are things we don't often think about. Like my number one advice for losing weight and building muscle and slowing down the aging process, I like to think of it actually as de-aging, is to get a good night's sleep consistently.
No, by the way, that's easier said than done with most people.
No kidding.
Yeah. What do we do? Is it supplement? Is the melatonin? Is the tryptophan? The rest of it? Or what? How do you get a good night's sleep?
So here's the deal. First of all, you have to make it a priority. Okay, and I think the reason sleep's gotten to be such a crisis, and by the way, it's one of the reasons I think that we have this obesity epidemic in children, is because kids now have TVs and iPhones and laptops in their rooms, and so they're staying up later. Really, I think the big challenge for us is that we've got too much stimulation around, you know, especially with most people seeming to have, if they aren't bringing work home from the office, they're running a business out of their home, and the draw to email late at night and the internet, it's just too much, and it really stimulates your brain. So what I teach people to do is something I actually stole from Dr. Michael Bruce, the sleep doctor, is to implement the power down hour. Make a decision that you're going to get 7 to 9 hours of quality sleep a night. And so if you're getting up at 6, that means that you need to be asleep by 11. So at 10 o'clock, it's the power down hour. And that means all electronics go off.
Oh, it hurts.
I know. People are like, no, don't take that away.
JJ, does Prozac go with the program?
Well, you know what? Here's the deal. So just get in the bathtub, because most likely you're not going to be in the bathtub with your computer, although I did catch, you know, someone in there with their iPhone. So you really do have to be disciplined with this, because I can't tell you how many people come to me and they're tired and they want something for their energy, but they're not sleeping well.
Yeah. And right? By the way, no question, you've got to be able to sleep. Your body and your brain especially is an electrochemical factory. And if you don't do the right things, you're not going to get the right chemicals to go to the right place to fix what needs to be fixed.
Well said. And, you know, that's what my mantra is your body is not a bank account. It's a chemistry lab. And when you, one poor night of sleep, just one, by the way, and then, of course, this becomes an additive effect, your body has higher cortisol, which makes you store more fat around your waistline, raises the set point for burning it off. That higher cortisol impairs digestion. You can't digest your protein as well, so now you can't, you know, make your hormones and make better hair, skin, and nails. You are more insulin resistant, which means that your blood sugar is going to be higher. You're going to be better at storing fat. Your ghrelin's higher. That makes you hungrier. So you can see what a mess this is. Your serotonin's lower. You're craving sugar. And that's just one night.
Yeah.
Right?
By the way, no question about it. And it boils down to this, and I've discussed this on the air time and again because I think it's an important issue, very rapidly. You and I walk into the room and we see each other. We meet. One of two things are going to happen. I'm going to get an adrenaline rush, or I'm going to get a dopamine rush. The adrenaline rush, you're going to scare me, or I'm going to scare myself through you, and I'm going to defense out immediately, and there's going to be a problem. And the other way, I look at you, and I recognize something I like, I get a dopamine rush, I feel good. We don't realize how chemicals affect our body, our moods, and our emotions. And if you tie that into health, all of a sudden you've got answers that were in front of you but you didn't recognize before.
Exactly. It's so huge. And we are so sensitive about those things, and it's all tied together. So again, you don't sleep well now, you can't digest as well now, you don't have the proteins you need to make those brain chemicals. So it's simple things, and I think part of this is just going back to the basics of getting good night's sleep, taking time out each day to have some fun, especially with women. I'll ask them, okay, well, what did you do for fun? You know, and they look at me like, I took my son to the soccer game. I'm like, no. That was fun for your son. What about you? Right? We just, that tends to get kind of pushed to the wayside.
No question about it. And when it really comes down to it, we have been trained that we're not supposed to have anything good. You got to do it for somebody else. And by the time everybody's mm-hmm. doing it for somebody else, nobody feels good.
Exactly. And that's, so one of the prescriptions is you must take time for downtime. It's to really rebuild your brain chemicals that you brought up. It's so important. So not only sleeping, but having some fun, taking time out for bliss, whatever that is, whether it's, you know, going out and walking the dog, going for a bike ride. I always want to do things where you're outside and you're getting some sunshine, some vitamin D, some sunlight. But stuff that lets you be creative. As one of my girlfriends says, she goes, I don't get any of my great business ideas when I'm sitting at my desk.
Yeah. No, and by the way, that makes so much sense. It's called get away from it. Just walk away. And my greatest ideas, and I'm serious, at 3 o'clock in the morning, if I get up and go down the hallway and I'm heading to that wonderful room that we head to at 3 o'clock in the morning, a thought will hit me and I'll go, oh, that's the answer to it. It's when you're not thinking about it, you're not stressing, you're not putting your head to something to try to figure something out, that's when your answers come.
Exactly. So we've got, you know, stress less, sleep deep, and those are two key areas that I think people don't generally think of when they think of, oh, you know, this is going to be a fat loss and fitness plan. And, you know, interestingly enough, those are my two top areas I work with on people. Those are generally the issues. Because if those are messed up, you won't have the stamina and willpower that you need to eat correctly and exercise.
See, I think the key really is this, when somebody like yourself is giving this kind of information out. You know, you You're a nutrition expert. You're a fitness expert, a writer, a professional speaker. You've been doing radio personality, and you've been doing this for 25 years now. In that period of time, I guess the real wisdom comes from not so much the original education where you get your foundation and base, but the wisdom comes from actually working with people, actually putting what you have to work and seeing what works and what doesn't work. And after a period of time, you eliminate all the stuff that doesn't work, and what you end up with is something successful.
You know, what's interesting is, I mean, the bottom line, when you are, I started out as a personal trainer paying my way through graduate school. I've now got 40 graduate and doctoral classes. I just kept taking classes to search for the answers, but it was very clear early on that what I was being taught in school, which is that your body is this bank account. If you want to lose weight, I mean, we've all heard this, just eat less and exercise more. Now, I find it hard to believe that that equation holds true, and we've got 70-plus percent of the population overweight or obese and obese kids. Obviously, there's more stuff going on here, and that's what I set out to find out. And I, along the way, became an expert in what I call weight loss resistance. And it's all of these areas from your genetics. I mean, genetics play anywhere from 40 to 70% role in your weight, huge, to toxicity, insulin resistance, sleep, cortisol, stress, you know, all of these things play major roles, and you've got to address them. Otherwise, you set people up where they go, you know, gee, I'm eating better, I'm exercising, but nothing's really happening, you know, and then they feel like a loser. And it's not that they're not doing it right. It's that they've got either some genetics working against them or they've damaged their metabolism, and they may have to do some other things to heal that.
Oh, JJ, the weight in and of itself could be a defense mechanism. It could be a mask so they don't have to get out there and prove to themselves what they think about themselves. I've seen it time and time again. The weight is a protection mechanism. And if they lose the weight, you know, that's that old adage, better unhappy than unsure, because they're not quite sure what they're going to deal with. I remember, 20 years ago, I was doing an interview, and they had gone through the bypass. And I had six people in there. One guy had just gone through it, and he was still very heavy, probably 270, 280 pounds, down to a woman who was absolutely gorgeous, but she went the reverse on it. She got her, you know, her rear end tucked, and she got a breast implant. She went all the way. She lost the weight, and she started implementing. So that's one extreme to the other. But I remember the question that I asked. I said, you met your wife and you're this particular guy. You've got this personality. This is the way you look. This is who she fell in love with. This is who she married. You lose 150 to 200 pounds. And is she going to stay with you? And he looked at me, and then she called the show and she says, yes, I love you. I will. But I, you know, it was 20 years ago. Who knows if they stayed together? Because
right.
One of the things that people run into when they drop all this weight is the people that fell in love with them for the person they were with the weight, now it's not just the weight that goes, everything else changes too.
Oh, we had that. When I was on Dr. Phil for two seasons when he launched his whole weight loss program, and we had that going on big time. We had partners sabotaging because they were afraid. We literally had, I remember one man came on the show, we weren't positive what he weighed because he couldn't get off the couch. He weighed 800 yeah. pounds around that. And plus, how do you weigh someone who weighs 800 pounds.
Very carefully.
But his wife was scared to death that if he lost weight, women would find him. She said, he's so attractive that I'm afraid if he loses any weight, you know, he'll leave me.
Yeah.
She was basically holding him hostage on the couch, right? So, you know, there's so many issues between the emotional issues of this and the genetic issues of it and the biochemical issues of it. But I don't want to paint a picture because that sounds very doomy gloomy. And yeah. I really believe that, you know, I believe in anything in life you can have whatever it is that you desire, unless, of course, you're 5 feet tall and you want to be 6 feet tall. That's not going to happen.
you wear high heels, yeah.
Exactly. But other than that, you know, if you want to change your life, what I tell people is genes may load the gun, but your lifestyle triggers that. You might have a high obesity index. It doesn't mean that you will be obese. You know, it just may mean you have to work a lot harder, right? And you don't have the margin for error. But
sure.
You really do, whether you're trying to have better arms or you're trying to reduce your cardiovascular risk or you want more energy, it's all pretty much the same formula of the way that you eat, which I think most people are following what they think is healthy out there, which actually is hurting them, and then your type of exercise, and ditto on that, and then stress and sleep and detoxification. They're key.
Oh, yeah. By the way, I have a tremendous fan club out there. I mean, it's really big and is growing daily. And the fan club is the I Hate Michael Ray fan club. And the reason for the fan club is I can eat 3 meals, 2 desserts, and lose a half a pound the next morning. And every time
so
I say that.
So we just need to bottle that up, man. We'll be partnership.
You got it. But when it really comes down to it, I get people joining every day, and I've got a couple of people that I'll be chairman of the group here. But the point of contention is, you know, thank goodness I was blessed with that. I've got a very high metabolism, so I do the reverse. I have to stuff myself to keep weight. And I've been a bodybuilder for 50 years now, so I believe in everything.
Well, see,
that
makes a huge difference.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, having active muscle tissue changes everything.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and when people talk about, you know, anti-aging and the rest of it, it's you have the power within yourself to do it. Your chemicals are going right. Your nutrition is good. And you don't look as old as you are. Now, you go to my website, you look at the picture there. For 97, I'm looking good. But for 27, it looks like I've had a pretty rough life. No good, huh?
I gotta check you out. But I will tell you, I have one client who came to me at 75, told me he looked great. Told me he looked great, right? And I said, well, except for what about that big belly you got? Like, he had great muscle tone in this big belly, right? And he kept telling me how great he was. And I said, you know, we got down to what he was eating. And, I mean, he was eating a big bowl. Oops, now I turned your website on. It yelled at me. He was eating this big bowl of cereal every single morning. We flipped his diet, and that guy was down to, I think he was down to 12% body fat, you know, 75. Just awesome. I mean,
oh, and by the way,
a 25-year-old would kill to have that body.
Yeah, any way that you want to have it, you can have it, okay? Are you on the website?
I am on the website.
Okay, see that so the picture of me on the website, on that homepage, that was taken about 4.5-5 months ago at the very most. I'm going to be 69 this year.
So what we need here, how come you're not sleeveless, Michael?
No, I could. We've got them too.
Got to see you in action here, but you make the important point. And one of the things I was listening to one of my favorite doctors speak about health, and he said, you know, the bottom line is this is all cumulative. So the longer you exercise, the better. The longer you eat well, the better. It's not to say, hey, don't start now, but it is to say, start right now. If for some reason you aren't doing it, please don't wait till tomorrow, because tomorrow never, ever happens. As we know, it never comes. And every day counts, because it's going to count in the way your genes express themselves. It's going to count in your muscle mass being more energetic and active and having the right chemical responses. It's going to slow down the aging process. I mean, you just show, and I love the idea that once you're past the age of 30, you know, it's all up to your lifestyle. And, you know, it's like the great equalizer, right?
Yeah. Now, by the way, two things are going to happen here. One is we're about out of time, so let me ask you for your website so we know where to contact you by the book.
All right, jjvirgin.com.
Okay, jjvirgin, V-I-R-G-I-N, jjvirgin.com.
Virgin, and, yeah, just like Virgin Mary or Virgin Airlines.
I got it. And by the way, I'm going to send you a picture, and it's a decent picture. I have clothes on, and it's not like wiener, okay? I'm going to send you a picture that was taken right around a year ago. Just to talk about anti-aging. All right, so hey, JJ, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. As my grandmother would say, go out and kick some posterior. You're doing a wonderful job.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, good night.
Bye.
The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as your fire.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
As they say in this business, that's all there is. There isn't isn't anymore. We'll share the moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends.